We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch, a podcast of inspiring stories from women shaping leadership. If you're interested in the nonprofit sector or happen to be working in a nonprofit, this is going to be an interesting interview for you. My guest this week is Vivian Hsu, and she is the founder and CEO of Lendinate, a company that brings together investors and nonprofits. Don't forget to follow us on our YouTube channel at W2W Media and subscribe if you're someone who likes to watch the show. And as always, stay with us during the breaks where you'll hear from our watch team of corporate partners bringing you information and news from their organizations. So now I'm very honored and excited to welcome to the show Vivian Hsu. Vivian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
It's great to have you. I wanted to start off the interview and talk a little bit about your time in Hong Kong. I know you were born there. You came over here as a young girl, seventh grade, I would say, is fairly young. Tell me what you miss most about Hong Kong.
Oh, boy. It's been a while, so I feel like I'm so adjusted now that thinking back what I missed is different at different stages. I think initially, of course, as a teenager, my friends, I think this was, of course, before there was internet and all that, and communicating that with them was a little bit harder. So I would write letters, but eventually the distance between letters were a little bit, you know, stretched out as I was getting more acclimated to life in Des Moines, Iowa. So that was nice. But I can say that last year I had a chance to have a mini reunion with a couple of my best friends from grade school. And because for work, they were here in California and we got together.
Yeah, that must have been very nice.
Yes.
After all that time.
Yeah,
exactly. I also know that you're the youngest of six. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the baby of six is kind of out there on their own, trying to find their way. Tell me a little bit about your upbringing. I know that your parents are very much a role model for you. And I'd love for you to just talk about why that is and what their teachings and their parenting style was.
Yeah, I think I didn't fully realize how lucky I was to have them as parents until maybe I was in college talking to other people. Their style was very much hands-off, partly because probably I was number six and everything's been done. They were more mature in their life as well, given that I was, you know, the last one. So they were always very, now I can use these words to describe them because I recognize being a parent myself now, how important it is to have that calmness and the reassurance that we're okay. The always instilling values in us through their own actions. It's not just talk. For example, my sister, the sister who was just older than me, and I would reminisce and back to the old days when we were in Hong Kong and how we never heard a single complaint or gossip, basically, from my parents. So we always were left with the impression that their friends were perfect. Like, oh, wow, you know, when we grow up, we need to have friends like that. Everybody's perfect. Because it was just, you know, they didn't need to, you know, kind of complain about things in front of the kids. And even between them, the two of them, they've really never argued that we've witnessed. So when my mother, who's passed away, you know, a couple of years ago at age 100, but before that, I had a chance to ask her, did you just not argue or argue privately? And she's like, no, you know, if we had a disagreement, we would just talk things out. So she and dad really just never had arguments. So I grew up in an environment like that.
Yeah, quite. I guess they were private, you know, more private. I know, you know, moving to the United States in seventh grade is a big deal. And I think especially for young girls having to start all over with the friends. And how did you assimilate when you were first here?
Yeah, initially it was a struggle, obviously, because of language. I had studied English in Hong Kong. It was a British colony at the time. So writing and reading, the grammar, all that I could get. I didn't have the vocabulary to support what I wanted to express. And sometimes, you know, of course, getting into a new environment, pronunciation wasn't quite there. And therefore, I just resorted to not speaking a lot. Who actually helped me out to transition was actually my nephew. So as I mentioned, I have six siblings, and my oldest sister's son, my nephew, and I are actually, we're in the same grade. We're just about a year apart. So at school, you know, if I had any questions, like, how does that work? Why does, you know, that doesn't make sense. Why is it like this? I had so many questions that he helped me really fully integrate into life in Des Moines.
And tell me what you were aspiring to be at that age. What were you thinking about when you thought about your future and people asking you, what do you want to be when you grow up?
In all transparency and honesty, also, I'm going to hide behind the fact that I was the youngest. I honestly don't think I had like big aspirations. I didn't think, you know, when I grow up, I want to be, you know, an entrepreneur or something. It was just always, you know, kind of like, okay, I'll study hard. And then I will, you know, do all this kind of what I understand I should do. And then I'll figure it out along the way. Well, I'm sure we'll get into along the way, a lot of things happened. But yeah, I think a lot of times younger kids, we the youngest in the family, we kind of get a pass if we choose that path to not try to dream big. I don't know.
You obviously did well in school, I would imagine, having an MBA and a degree in applied mathematics from Berkeley. So would you say, you know, when we think about school that, you know, is that the left brain or the right brain? I always forget. But that your strength was in with numbers and math and science. Was that always the case?
It was probably always the case. I don't think I discovered that again until later on in higher education. So again, I'm always very transparent and honest, and hopefully some people will resonate with my early these stories, so that if you have young daughters or, you know, it's never too late. I still remember my last final exam when I graduated from Berkeley. And I was so happy when I put down my pencil. It was math 185, very difficult. And then I put down my pencil and I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I will never have to take another exam ever again. Boy, was I wrong. So what changed my mind eventually, of course, was other people who inspired me. I ended up working at a company where I just felt, wow, everyone here is so smart. I want to be like them. And so I decided to pursue my MBA, pursue the CFA, the Chartered Financial Analyst exams, Yeah, so many, many exams followed.
Right. So many more tests when you go
into,
yes, the financial field. I want to share this quote. You said, "I became a Christian at age 16, and it has been my North Star ever since." And I was curious about what was happening in your life at that age of 16 that motivated you to pursue a new faith.
Mm. In Hong Kong, I actually went to a Catholic school. So I was taught a lot of the like the Bible stories, I'll say, and the principles. But I think maybe a combination of I was young, it was taught in a way that really didn't click for me. Excuse me. And so it wasn't until I was in Des Moines and my sister, who I had mentioned before, she became a Christian first. And then she said, "Hey, you know what? Some of the things we've learned are not maybe exactly as we understood them to be." And so because of that, then I started going to a Protestant church in Des Moines. Another story there. But and when I was 16, I made my declaration of faith. That this I fully believe that the Bible is a God-given message to us, His creation, and that ever since then has been my understanding of the worldview, why we do what we do, who we are, and what we need to do to be a good citizen, a good Christian in life.
Do you think that that has played a role in, we'll talk a little bit about your career, which was, you know, with large investment firms, financial firms, that you had an underlying desire to do something of social good?
Absolutely. I do feel that, you know, now that, you know, I'm many, many years from 16, right. I've had many years of living that life and, you know, course correcting sometimes and adjusting to it. I do feel that my faith has definitely deepened to a level of understanding where, yes, everything I do is because I feel that this is what God would want, because what He wants us is to love our neighbors, to help the people who are vulnerable. And if we have the means, we should do it. And for some people, the means is money. So we donate. So for some people, it's certain type of talents and some sort of level of caring. Everybody comes to this with our specific gifts in our lives that we can help enable better lives for others.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your career prior to launching Lendinate and see what it was that helped you in your journey as an entrepreneur.
Sounds good.
This is, we go into our first break and we will be back with Vivian Hsu.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
As a female-led organization, you have to bring it every single day. We're a mashup of sort of right and left brain. So we're not just doing management consulting. We're not just doing creative services. We're not just producing an event, but we're bringing a comprehensive solution to our clients. And because of the way we approach it, we end up being bought into what it is that we're doing in a way that we truly have as much skin in the game as our clients do, whether it's bringing affordable internet to communities across the Caribbean, or it's helping Comcast with their Internet Essentials program, which is something we've been very proud to work on, or it's helping the NFL celebrate their centennial season by getting 1 million people to give at least 100 minutes to causes they care about, or helping the city of Philadelphia win the World Cup. So what's next for us? Well, we just hit just over 100 employees. I think we are at that tipping point, and I don't think there's anybody that does it better than we do. I'm Maggie Wilkinson, CEO of Athena Global Advisors, a company that is proudly based in Philadelphia.
Hi, I'm Katie Gore, the president of Quidel Consulting and Training. There are a lot of myths about affordable housing and the people who need and live in affordable housing. One myth, for example, only people who are unemployed need and live in affordable housing. The reality is that many people in affordable housing actually have working full-time jobs. Teachers, healthcare workers, service employees, people who are essential in our communities. They often struggle to afford rent in so many communities across the nation. And that's what's the beauty about affordable housing. They are providing work in the communities at an affordable rent. Another myth is that affordable housing increases crime. Studies consistently show there is no link between affordable housing and increased crime. In fact, stable housing can reduce crime by providing security and fostering stronger community neighborhoods and building attachment for the people who live in affordable housing. For more information about affordable housing and to walk through some more of those myths, you can find me and my segment on the Women to Watch platform.
Welcome back to the show. I'm speaking this week with Vivian Hsu, and Vivian is the founder and CEO of Lendinate, which is a company that brings together philanthropists and investors with nonprofits. I want to talk, before we talk about the launch of the company, you spent time as an executive with several financial firms at the highest level, Charles Schwab, American Century Investments, U.S. Trust. How did that prepare you to run your own company?
It prepared me in a way that I understood the structures of capital markets, big fancy word for big, you know, big areas of investment type of dollars, as well as what regulators want. Regulators want investment products to make full disclosures of what risks are involved. If it's low risk, still you have to disclose it. So understanding the depth of what it takes to run a company that needs to be compliant with different types of regulators, I think is, from that perspective, it helped me understand what it means to run my own business. And then, of course, I'll expand on that as it comes to product design as well.
Yeah, well, feel free. Yeah.
Yeah. So in my job at Charles Schwab Asset Management, I used to oversee all the active equity strategies that encompassed, I think at some point, 8 to 9 mutual funds and 4 other separately managed accounts, portfolio accounts. And so to design a strategy and decide what to launch and what to reshape really does take the understanding of what the average investor needs and wants. Average investor, because it's mutual fund. Mutual fund is accessible to everyone, unlike hedge funds and private equity. So my job was to think about that basically day in and day out. When I was there over the 7 years, we launched 3 new funds, and then we also repositioned several others. So that work involved working with across the company, with compliance, with legal, product management, marketing, technology, you know, you name it, we had to work across and be very collaborative to bring a new product to life. That's an atypical path for mutual fund portfolio managers, because usually, you know, portfolio managers just focus on the portfolio. But because I had that extra responsibility, it allowed me to understand the inner workings of like a mini company.
So thinking about today's environment, are you happy that you're not back in those roles?
In so many ways.
I would imagine. Go ahead.
Life of an entrepreneur, I think if you must have interviewed many entrepreneurs, it's hard to go back because the entrepreneurial life is so fun. People talk about career development, career as having a three-legged stool, financial reward, career growth, kind of like, going up the corporate ladder, and then job satisfaction. The job satisfaction is through the roof as an entrepreneur. So it will be hard to go back. Not saying I'm planning to.
Yeah, but it's a risk, right? Because of the security. You left something that probably felt secure. So tell me about the light bulb moment for Lendinate. Where were you and what were you doing when you realized this was something that was needed in both the investment world and nonprofit?
Yeah, that is a culmination of basically the past, all my adult life from work and volunteer work. Early 2015, I was at a fundraiser for a school. And then, we're eating the wonderful meal served by the students. And the school was talking about their plan to expand and move from a rental property to purchase property. The whole entire project was going to be $16 million. And they had already a bank tell them, if you bring $8 million, we'll, lend you $8 million. To make a long story short, the school had been preparing for this. So they had close to the $8 million they need to bring to the table, but they were short by a little bit. And as they shared how they could actually get like a small grant here or a small grant there to make up the difference, I was thinking, wow, this is hard because the property is available. If, there's further delay, then maybe the property would be sold to somebody else. So what went on in my mind while I was eating was that, there are a lot of people here enjoying this meal. What if we came together to offer a crowdsourced loan to the school, help them bridge to what the bank needs to see. And then when they get the building, with tuition and all that, then they can just over time pay us back. So that concept, of course, is not new. There are fintech companies that are doing that for small businesses, for student loans, for, all types of loans, except for nonprofits. So I dug into this, researched some more, went back to Berkeley, where I went to school, talked to a professor who is the faculty lead on the nonprofit management, kind of just asking everyone, is this a good idea? And then after talking to many people, then I did my own soul searching and talked to my husband, should I quit my job? So that's what I did.
That's a big conversation.
Yes. I'm so glad he's very supportive still to this day. He has been supportive. And that's also unique. You know how with every couple, there are dynamics. He and I, a lot of times, we like, I like blue and then he'll like, purple or something like that. This was one of the few ideas where I said, hey, what about this? And then asking me 100 questions, they said, I think you may have something there. So that's when I thought, even if he's saying yes, right, let me keep exploring.
Yes. So for the viewers and the listeners who are not familiar with Lendinate, can you just describe briefly what it is and maybe one of your favorite partnerships that you've brought together, maybe one of your favorite nonprofits that you've been able to help?
Yeah, no, fantastic. So we are what is called a two-sided marketplace. If you go on our website, you'll see there are loans posted on there that you investors can invest in. The way it works is that nonprofits apply for a loan to us. We do the due diligence and credit underwriting. We assess their ability to repay. That's the primary goal. And of course, do other due diligence at the same time. If we approve them, then they go on our marketplace, and to help investors decide whether this is something they want to invest in, not only do you get to read about their causes, area they serve, but we also put a risk rating on each loan so that it's gold, silver, or bronze, so that investors can decide based on their own risk tolerance what they want to invest in. So investors get to choose the specific nonprofit that they want to support, not just a general cause. And then we are the true lender, which means that we're responsible for getting the money back to each investor. We're doing that loan servicing for both sides of the marketplace. I'll add one more thing. If you notice our name, Lend Donate, the donation element can come in at the beginning or during the loan. So someone can say, you know, I want to lend to this nonprofit. I have $10,000 and I will, you know, take market rates return for that. We also can allow them to choose to receive a lower interest rate because people sometimes just say, you know what, I don't need to take market rate. I'll just charge them 2% interest. We will facilitate all of that all into the single loan, including a donation that can come later as a form of loan forgiveness. So investors, if they want to, they can continue to receive the interest repayment and just as their own return on investments, or they can say, you know, I only have X dollars left in the loan. I'm just going to forgive it. They don't have to pay me. We take care of all that paperwork for both sides of the marketplace as well.
Yeah, that's wonderful, because there's a philanthropy side where I'm assuming people come to the site and they see an organization and they just want to give.
Yes. Yeah. And sometimes it's the reverse. They are already a donor to the nonprofit. We've had that happen. Somebody sees the project and go, oh, I've been volunteering with them for years and I've done, you know, consistent donor. I'm happy to help support them with a loan. So it goes both ways in the sense that it can be a donor coming on or investor learning about a new nonprofit and eventually turning to be a donor if they choose.
Has there been an organization that's become kind of near and dear to your heart or perhaps moved you to, you know, I know you do, you sit on several boards and you do volunteer work yourself, but I'm wondering if there has some been an organization coming through your program or your company that you've discovered?
Yeah. Okay. I love, it's hard to pick, you know, like your child,
I'm
hard
sure.
to pick your favorite child. I'll share two very quickly because they have different perspectives. The first one is a loan application. This nonprofit has been around for over 20 years and they provide community health training and advocacy work with local grassroots so that the leaders can go train people to take care of themselves. And anyway, so really wonderful community health organization. They were expanding into a new area of services where the contracts are with private providers as opposed to just government grants. And so as they were going along, hiring people to go after those contracts, and they were running lower and lower on cash reserves to a point where they really needed a working capital loan very quickly. We thought that was a little bit of a challenge, but we found a way to make it work. We credit underwrote them, put them on the marketplace. So $100,000, 12-month loan. In the end, they prepaid in 7 months because they didn't need the loan anymore. And another year goes by after they paid, fully repaid. The executive director called me and said, I just wanted to call and tell you that when no one wanted to give us a loan, banks said no, when we couldn't get a grant, you did. And that their revenue grew three times what they were when they applied for a loan. And they went from about 150 employees to 300. There's part three of this story. Then, you know, we stayed in touch. Last year, she said, we received a large grant. We ourselves, our operation is already, you know, better than break even. So we don't need that grant to pour into our working capital. We're going to reserve that as a way to grant other smaller or nonprofits that serve in the same area as they do, so that they become a grantor to other nonprofits. And that transformation is truly what we want to see over and over again, that we give the seed capital so that they can grow to be their own unicorn.
That's a wonderful story. And it all began with you.
Yeah. So we'll pat ourselves on the back because that one was truly like we were able to identify the impact they were making in their community as well as their business. So we have to vet them based on the ability to repay, which is the strength of their own operations. And we did see that, you know, trying to diversify your revenue source was a very smart thing to do. So we wanted to support their efforts. And if I can squeeze in my other story, which is short, but this story really goes to the heart of what a lot of people really want, not the nonprofits, what people want to do for nonprofits. We have an investor lender on our platform where he had told me that, hey, I don't like these gold, silver, bronze things. I want to take risk with the nonprofits. So one time when we had a loan application, we would have needed to decline because it was just, we couldn't see we couldn't be assured there was ability to repay. It's a small nonprofit that serves in California seniors, veterans, so older veterans who are homeless. And they just like to have a small place with 12 beds. But because of COVID, there was disruption. They couldn't serve for a little while in person. So then the revenue came down, right? They get reimbursed for the services they provided. And we couldn't give them a loan, which means, you know, bad things would happen. And then fortunately, I remembered this investor. So I called him. I said, hey, David, I remember what you said. Here's the situation. What do you think? And he said, oh, yeah, you got me. This is the type of things I want to do. I don't know if they can repay me, but if my money can even help them do 6 more months of good work, so be it, right? I don't need it back. But if they pay me back, I'll do it again. So that's exactly what happened. The nonprofit was able to not only recover from that period, they got large grants subsequently, and then they repaid David in 16 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
These are great stories. Do you show these on your website?
Yeah, we have select success stories we show to illustrate kind of the type of financing we can provide, sometimes big projects, right? Real estate construction, and sometimes $50,000 loans just for, you know, a local youth empowerment nonprofit to provide after school work in their area. And sometimes it's just a working capital. For-profit companies, for small businesses, can borrow from the SBA, you know, the Small Business Bureau. But SBA does not generally lend to nonprofits. So nonprofits actually do not have the same access as some of the small businesses have, which is the lifeline for any business to run things, because cash flow is just not usually doesn't come in, you know, regular pieces. It's very chunky. And sometimes you need that seed capital to kickstart something bigger.
Yeah, that's really impressive. And, it, you know, one of my questions for you was, how does it feel to be doing such meaningful work? Mm. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, it's both so encouraging every day. I always think back to the COVID period. You know, COVID period was hard for everyone, nonprofits, for-profit like us, individuals. And there are times when I feel like, oh my gosh, like if this lasts any longer, I don't know if LendDonate will survive. But periodically, then I would talk to some nonprofit leader, whether it's executive director or a board member. The grit and the determination they will stick around to provide for their community sometimes is so strong and inspiring that I end up getting inspired by the nonprofits I talk to. Like, well, if they're sticking around, we definitely do everything to make sure we're sticking around. We're not gonna throw in the towel. So I learn a lot from nonprofit leaders. They're really just truly very, they're scrappy. Like, okay, we can get resources here. We can get resources there. They build relationships. They have visions, not visions, but you know, they're visionaries. Where they see that, you know, through their organization, they can transform one community at a time. That's just very inspiring to me.
Vivian, I wanted to ask you about advice that you would have for someone that happens to be watching or listening and is thinking about starting their own nonprofit.
Yeah. So many people are wanting to help, especially now, right? Thinking like, oh, how can I contribute to my community? I would say, first of all, there are over a million nonprofits in the country with a very long tail. And what I mean is there are a lot of small nonprofits because they have their local area and knowledge, and they start a nonprofit and they have, you know, maybe a couple of staff members or maybe just by themselves. They are so, the hyper-local is so helpful, but they're also so hard to run and make the financials work out. So I would say if someone has an idea, check with the community foundation near them. A lot of community foundations or organizations like that has programs of what's called fiscal sponsorship. No need to set up your own organization just yet. Get your project sponsored by a foundation and then get the operation going and at the right time, then spin off to be a 501c3. I think that's usually a easier path for everybody involved.
Okay, great. Terrific. Yeah. Well, listen, I thank you so much for spending some time with me today and talk about your life story and your career.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
Stay with me as we go into our last break, and I'll be back to close out the show.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 companies through my work at the EXCO Group, a firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior executives grow. Today, I'd like to speak about how to deal with a toxic work environment. While there are some well-documented cases of blatantly toxic cultures, toxicity in the workplace is often a more subtle nature, which can even be more dangerous to one's mental health and well-being. So how can one deal with a toxic relationship? While the path of least resistance may be avoidance, this isn't the healthiest of approaches, as odds are the negative behavior is often not just towards one person, but anyone that the person may perceive as a threat. As difficult as it may be, I encourage having a direct conversation. Plan and rehearse what you want to say. Be sure to stay diplomatic, but stand strong and be sure to address your concerns in a clear and concise manner. And in return, be ready to listen to what the other person has to say. Remember, no one has the right to make you feel uncomfortable in the workplace. Have another person moderate the conversation if needed. Also, escalate if there's no resolution. Looking back, perhaps the biggest mistake I made early on in my career as a new leader was tolerating poor behavior from one individual because I thought he was so smart and so invaluable to the company. What I failed to recognize was the mental and productivity impact that his behavior was having on the team as a whole. I didn't fire him, although the next manager did. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, visit excoleadership.com to learn more.
Over on our Women to Watch YouTube channel, we have a partner profile series featuring some of the amazing executive women working at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Our latest installment features Dr. Susan Firth. Here's an excerpt from our latest conversation. The goal, I would say, of CHOP is for every child to have a chance at a healthy future. And how does the Research Institute specifically support and help in that goal?
One of our strategic imperatives as an enterprise is to really promote research-driven precision medicine, you know, so diagnostics and therapeutics that are really tailored to an individual's circumstance. And I always add to that research-driven precision medicine that this has to be research-driven precision medicine for everyone. So we've invested in programs around health equity, research methods, and making sure that as we are pursuing our research and discovery, that we're thinking about how our questions apply to different populations, whether it's where they live, if they're rural or urban, or what their social determinants of health are. So we're trying to incorporate thinking broadly about improving child health to all populations. So we want to help children who are around the world and also in our backyard.
To learn more about Dr. Susan Firth, head over to our Women to Watch YouTube channel for the full interview.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first-of-its-kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks so much for being with me. Joining me next week will be Shalonda Armstrong, and she is the founder of KM Ventures. Thank you, as always, to our sponsors for helping us to bring you the show each and every week, and I'll see you next time.
If you're looking for legit ways to make extra money, you've got to check out The Side Hustle Show. With hundreds of actionable episodes to choose from, you'll learn what's working now from real people making real money. Like the Utah mom who built a six-figure business playing video games, or the guy earning $3,000 a month renting out mobility scooters. Online or offline, from Amazon to your own hometown, from YouTube to vending machines, The Side Hustle Show has you and your wallet covered. Subscribe to The Side Hustle Show wherever you're listening to this podcast and increase your earning power today.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now. And support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.